Welcome to the after party. It's time to change. You're just getting started. You can teach an old dog new ways, and not just on Saturdays.
Hey, it's Anna David here with After Party Pod, the podcast all about addiction recovery, all that falls in between. And yeah, so I'd like to introduce you, if you've never listened before, thank you. I'd like to introduce myself. I just did. If you have listened before, I will be honest and tell you that based on a recent iTunes review, I have made an effort. I'm going to be honest, the review was harsh. But I was thinking, it's the harshest lessons that we learn the most from. And I don't believe that the reviewer was wrong, but because I notice when I listen to this podcast that I do a lot of right and ums, and so I was very conscious of not doing that during the interview you're about to listen to. Maybe you're, a cool person, and you were never judging me for that. Good. You may not notice the difference. I think I will when I listen back, but I just did it. See, it's about progress, not perfection, as they say. But I think that we're always trying to improve ourselves, and I am looking for feedback. If it comes in the form of a 2-star review, written by somebody who, when I clicked on her name, I'm always convinced it's a her. I'm not sure. Aunt Freud, what does that mean about me? But she'd given a number of 2-star reviews to a number of people and things, and sometimes they say that if you feel the same way about a bunch of different things or people, maybe, when there's a finger pointing forward, there's 3 pointing back. I don't know. She mentioned my quote-unquote vocal ability, which seemed, I don't know. I get paid to speak, so I don't know how bad my vocal ability is. Anyway, you can see I took this to heart. But I also took it as constructive criticism, and it did make me have to be far more conscious during the interview you're about to listen to, but maybe that was good. I don't know. I still really enjoyed having it, this conversation. It is with, I will finally get to why you maybe downloaded this. It is with John Heffron. An extremely funny guy. We were serious in this, but he is an extremely funny guy. And we know this because he won Last Comic Standing. Yeah, when it was a super popular game, he won it. He then appeared on the next, he won the second season. Then he next appeared on the third season and was a runner-up. And he's done a ton of stuff. He's been on I Love the 70s. I'm just looking at a bio, but he's been on The Tonight Show. He's been on Craig Kilborn. Remember him? He's been on Chelsea Lately. He's been on, all that stuff. And what we get into is he also created a card game that was very successful. The things you learn about people when you have them on a podcast. And we talked about his, we're not going to call it alcoholism. We get into a long conversation about what is alcoholism. He's not one for you're an alcoholic for life. He may not be an alcoholic. He did go to program. He has not had a drink in over 8 years. He believes his life is much better as a result of it. He has a lot of self-help in his background. He explains it all. I learned a lot. Neuro-linguistic programming, which I can barely say, although I have written it in a sentence. Some rehabs offer it. It was really interesting. He explains how that works. He talks about his career. He talks about what got him to, when was he drinking the most and why. And this amazing story. I don't want to ruin it for you, but it has to do with being maybe 6 months sober and buying this shot. And it's dramatic. It's great. A little laughter in this, a little tears possibly. It's some good stuff, and who knows, he and I may share an assistant and work on a card game together. That all came up in this episode, so I hope you love it. This is John Heffron.
I first started taking drugs by chewing blocks of hash.
Oh my God, I think my copy has like blood stains on it from shooting up while reading it. party animal. I hate to say that because that makes me sound Paris Hilton-y. I was on the, as I call it, the Autobahn to nowhere.
I'm very lucky because would you have wanted to have a celebrity junkie for a dad?
Get into this right now.
So we sat at a table together in the red eye. Like, I was in the leg chair.
Yes.
And who was our third person?
I have no idea. It was, who's that guy that, he used to be on, like, a lot of 80s sitcoms. Thomas. I remember that guy on it.
He has
a morning show. You know, he was on, like, not Rhoda, not, he was...
I have no idea.
Oh, it's going to kill me. I'll think of it later.
Now it's all coming back to me. Not him.
But it was about 7 or 8 years ago.
Yes.
So, I mean, it was a long time. And when you do a lot of panel shows, then, you know, you come across a lot of people. So
I had to sort of brown out Red Eye just because I have no business being on television talking about politics. Literally no business.
Yeah, I wonder. I think, well, either do I. So back then, which was a couple years, I mean, like you said, 70, maybe they weren't so... The guy who hosts that, right. I don't remember him being as political as he is now.
Well,
but, like, that's the hook. Guys like that, they go, where's our money? If we ever just talk normal and don't say crazy shit, then we're going to get fired. Because we have to do this because, you know what I mean?
Well, I know Greg.
Yeah.
And he's always been hyper-political.
Yeah, I don't remember the show, but maybe they switched it, you know what I mean?
Well, I don't... I lived in New York, and I started doing it, and just because I have that unfortunate thing where I can't say no because the opportunity will never come up again.
Right.
So I would do it and always... feel super uncomfortable. That being said, Greg, if you're listening, I'd love to come back anytime.
Yeah, exactly.
But, so I did it so much and always sort of felt stupid because I have no business talking about politics anywhere. Yeah. Anywhere, even in private conversation.
Yeah, I don't, I'm too wishy-washy. Like, I can go, here's what I, you know, the only thing I don't understand about politics is when people go, I'm a Dem or I'm a Republican. To me, they both want the same thing.
Really?
And it seems very like you're easily manipulated if you call allegiance to one because the other one knows how to control you by saying stuff that gets you mad. And I'm very big on nobody controlling me.
That's interesting. Again, here I am talking about politics when I have no business talking about politics. But I don't know if... I do know that there are things I believe that my more liberal friends, and all of my friends are my more liberal friends, do not agree with.
Right.
But it's mostly ignorance that makes me think I shouldn't be talking about it. But anyway, okay, so we met in New York doing that show,
right.
Which I had to brown out. A little bit.
Right.
And then we communicated over Twitter about your book.
Yes.
Let's talk about your book for a minute.
My book, I Come to You from the Future, mm-hmm. Is a book I wrote with a buddy of mine, Topher Morrison.
Who, thanks to you, I met.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
He's great.
Yes. I met Topher. Topher's like this, I don't know how to describe him. He does, he used to be really into self-help.
Mm-hmm.
He was one of those guys back when that whole genre of entertainment was popular.
Isn't it still?
Yeah, but he calls himself like a recovering self-help addict.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's a lot of people that are into self-help
mm-hmm.
that actually just go from like seminar to seminar to seminar but never apply anything that they're learning. And then those guys that run those self-help seminars are really good at anchoring feelings throughout the seminar to go, you know what, here you're learning a lot of stuff, but my next program, that's going to be the thing that's going to lock you in, and they start doing that, and then you just, you're always trying to fill that void, you know, in your gut, and then you go, here's another $1,500 seminar guy,
mm-hmm.
and it never, and then they leave, and your life is still exactly where it was, but now you're $1,500 shorter.
That's so interesting.
But Topher was never one of those guys, but he taught, like, NLP, neuro-linguistic programming, which I'm actually a fan of.
Mm-hmm. What is that exactly?
It's just about, and I guess we'll get into this a little bit further, on your show. It's basically just the words you choose to use really kind of create your reality.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, so I'm really like for the last, I don't know, 5 or 6 years, you know, how I talk or how I'm describing my life, I really choose those words correctly, because, you know, because when you hear something or somebody says something to you, you kind of create images in your head, or, you know, some people, you know, play movies, some people see just, you know, a single picture, and that's a lot of times when you play out scenarios, that will then determine how that reality is. So he used to teach all that, hypnosis, and then he got into corporate speaker training, mm-hmm. where that's how I met him. Mm-hmm. I went to one of his he had a 2-week seminar just on speakers skills. And I've done stand-up comedy for 23 years. So a lot of people are like, why would you need to go to do a speaker thing? Because there's a lot of, you know, I'm a big believer in just constantly trying to add more arsenals to my bandolier of how to deal with, you know, a scenario. So
that's smart.
Yeah. So after meeting him, we ended up bonding, super cool. And I've done a lot of stuff in my act where I look at young guys and I tell them, here's what's going to happen to you. We're all on the same straight line. You just grow into it. Like, so if you're in your early 20s, it, you know, you start to forward think going, man, once I get out of college and I get rid of my roommates and I have my own place, then my life's going to be bah. Mm-hmm. And then once which at that age, you don't realize that every new stage of your life, there's a shit ton of new problems nobody tells you about.
Right.
So you're never clear. You're always stepping in shit. Right. You're always, no matter where you are, no matter if you're like, man, if I would just make $100,000 a year, then, now you make $100,000. There's a whole bunch of shit you're going to step in once you make that much money. So right. There's never a thing. If you're broke at $30,000, you're going to be broke at $250,000.
Right.
Because you have...
You adjust.
I'm a broke guy. Yes. Right. You just start changing the portion.
Right.
So... I wrote a book just about where I give advice to... It's obviously I'm a dude, so it's kind of dude language-y, but mm-hmm. it's for anybody that age. Where I explain to them some of the stuff that happened to me, and it's probably going to happen to them, and here's some choices to get out of it. And the book bounces from just being funny, just, you know, random, just funny stuff from my act, to then... The very next chapter would be about me losing my mom and that whole story. Mm. And then the next chapter would be funny again. Mm-hmm. And then the next is actual business, how to negotiate. So it's very sporadic.
Make them laugh, make them cry, make them learn.
That's what with that book, I Come to Your Future on Amazon. I wrote it when I was on every flight I was on. That's the only time that I worked on it. Because mm-hmm. I fly, you know. 4 times a week, probably.
Jesus.
So I'm probably in the air 10, 15 hours a week.
And so you don't buy the Wi-Fi, you just concentrate.
I buy the Wi-Fi.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So every time I was on the flight, though, then that's when I would, you know, work on it. And, mm-hmm. you know, it's kind of interesting. It was my first, I would do a couple things differently with the book. I self-published it. Mm-hmm. I didn't even do a press release. I didn't launch the book correctly.
Right. Did you try to sell it sort of at your shows?
I sell it at my shows. I sell a lot of them at my shows.
So it's a printed book. It's not just online.
Yeah, you can get a physical copy. I just create space on Amazon, mm-hmm. and then I have the Kindle version. Mm-hmm. So you can get a physical copy.
You must sell a lot at your shows.
Yeah, I do. Yeah. And then Topher put in all his seminars that he used to do mm-hmm. that you're on DVD. We set some links up. So in the book, there's a page that lets you know, and you get like 10 hours of almost like... self-improvement type lecture, but it's really good. It's really, really cool info. Not cheesy, like,
right.
I'm going to show you how to firewalk. Like, I don't understand that. Because never once in life, like, if you have a job interview, are they going to have you firewalk to your job interview?
Isn't it metaphoric?
Yeah, but I would like practical.
Yes, I'm the same way.
Stuff. Like, you know, show me how to control, and I think I talk about this in the book, like, show me how to control my nerves before I walk in. You know, me going, yeah, I firewalked once, I'm still going to have nerves that day. You know, that doesn't mean that all my nerves go away. So, like, what do I do to kind of calm myself down and not, you know, mm-hmm. get me talking crazy when I walk in there?
So, how much do you think anxiety and neuro-linguistic programming has to do with addiction and, you know, being an addict and all of those things?
Yeah, you know what, I think for me... It's literally, like, about the words that you say in your head during that whole process. And I guess to back up a little, or to jump to that.
To come to us from the future.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I've been sober for almost 9 years now.
Mm-hmm.
And talking about how your language really dictates your thing. So I went to AA. And my... It's weird because I have internal conflicts with this. My low point was pretty high compared to everybody else, you know, mm-hmm. that you would hear. It was like I had no crazy... I set buildings on fire. I tried to kill anybody. I robbed. I had none of those stories.
Mm-hmm.
During the time that I think I was spinning a little out of control was my mom was dying.
Mm-hmm.
My mom was dying and I won Last Comic Standing.
Right.
So all in the same year, like I had kind of fame, money, you know, not that that thing, and then mom. So I like, and I had skills to, I had zero skills to deal with both.
So
zero.
So yeah, so pain and then sort of dreams coming true,
and then not knowing if I'm good enough to then you know right. like all this like pressure and blah blah blah. And, hey, John, do you want a TV show? Like so there was a time period there where I would drink a lot. Like I would just be like I don't know what to like crazy amounts, but I was never a big drinker leading up to that. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
I was in college and you and stuff like that, but I was also. But I was never a thing.
Mm-hmm.
But you did it every weekend. But then, you know, then the math could come in. Well, did you do it every weekend because you had a problem or because everybody that age does it every weekend? It's
did hazy. Weekends ever get longer for you? My weekend started to be sort of Wednesday through Sunday.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Point, you know.
You know, definitely. I would go out, I think, you know, every night, you know, meet somebody and stuff like that. But not get crazy boozed up.
Mm-hmm.
But you'd have a few. But when my mom was passing away, that's when I noticed it was a huge thing. So then I think I had one of those moments where I'm like, okay, why am I doing this?
Mm-hmm.
Like I was just, you know, like, wait. So I met another comic and she said, hey, you should, you know, I'll save a seat for you. We'll go to this meeting. It's no pressure. Just go. And I went, and that was the thing I needed to kind of put a period to just, you know, to put a scratch in the record.
Mm-hmm.
So the record wasn't constantly playing the same. That's what I needed, is that one little scratch. And then from there, went through the program, went to, like, a lot of meetings like everybody did. And
in L.A.? Or
mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah. Then I got into NLP, and then I started just reading on, you know, everything. I think I read, like, there's a book, I forgot the title, but it was, like, Buddha's 12 Steps or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
It was a really cool book. But then I had a little bit of a mind tweak where, okay, so after this process, after maybe the first couple months, maybe,
mm-hmm.
I never even thought about drinking. Like, it wasn't...
I get that.
So I hearing other people's stories, I got lucky because, like, my body physically, you know, like, I wasn't, like didn't have to go through anything.
No withdrawals or that
yeah,
kind
I think,
of thing.
You know, like, there's that first couple months because if you just... It's just breaking that habit. But I never really thought about, like, boozing and stuff like that. And I'm a stand-up comic, so every night... I'm in a scenario where everybody's drinking. So it wasn't like...
So what do you think that's about? You think it was just making a decision, or do you think that was a sort of spiritual moment that removed the desire?
Yeah, well, you know, it's one of those things where, and I might be fast-forwarding it too far from me figuring this out, where every time, let's say I wanted a drink, I would just ask myself, why do I want it?
Mm-hmm.
And then... If the answer was, well, I'm bored, or I'm nervous, or I want to do this and I don't have the courage, I would go, those are lame excuses. Because
mm-hmm.
I eventually figured out that, you know, if I'm in a scenario where I don't want to be in, that I would need booze to handle it, I leave that scenario.
And so you were never tempted in a club?
I bet you, out of, you know, 8 years, almost nine, I bet you there were like two times.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it... And they weren't even big. They were just like, and it was strictly out of boredom. Both times weren't because I was, you know, it was strictly out of boredom. So I would go to the meetings, but then I started noticing, and by the way, I'll preface this by saying I have zero case studies that this works on anybody else but me. So I just want to lay that down.
Don't do this at home.
Yes. I want to say any advice I'm getting is me talking back to myself, not necessarily to you listening.
Right.
I do not want that responsibility. This worked for me, and that's the only person
that you know of.
Because I've never done any studies to, to test this approach. I want to make that. So, but what I noticed is I start going to, you know, go to a lot of meetings, is the only time I ever thought of or even had the word booze in my head
was at a meeting.
Was after I left a meeting.
That's so interesting.
It was the only, like so I would go, you know, let's say I was traveling and I wouldn't go every day, like once I went through all my steps and stuff like that. And
oh, then, so you did do the steps?
Yeah, I did, I did everything. I did all my homework.
Okay, just once?
Yeah, just once, but then I got into NLP and I started just reading just everything, and then I replaced drinking like on the, when I was on the road. I would start working on my act, or like I said, a lot of it, if I was just out of boredom, I would just leave. You know, there's nothing.
Did you, so the desire to drink went away immediately when you went to program, or was it after doing the steps? Or did that not even make a difference?
Each step I did and each meeting I went helped me push all of that further and further away. I think it was a great thing to do, to just literally, if your life's in crazy, crazy chaos, you can just step away from that crazy chaos and take a breath and just kind of, you know, be in there, and you kind of just get into it.
So do you think maybe you're just not an alcoholic?
Here's my dilemma. Here, this is a struggle. So I went through that process, and then for however, you know, how long I was going, every day you'd stand up and go, I'm an alcoholic, Then I was having those internal struggles. Like, so, and not that I'm crazy NLP guy, but there are some moments, because like, I think in any type of self-helpy thing, there's a borderline religious occulty thing that you have to be careful that you don't dive too much in. So I'm a big believer. I take the greatest hits from every religion, every self-help thing, every kids cartoon, Disney thing with a message. I take the greatest hits and try to ball it all up into one. How can I be the coolest person ever?
Right.
And be happy and do this and do that.
So you're going to start your own religion.
I'm going to start my own religion. But I'm too lazy to start my own religion, definitely. So so I would say that, but then I start going, it's weird if you give yourself a label, right? Because if you say, if I tell somebody, you know, hey, do you want to have a drink? And I say, no, I don't drink. Then they'll say, you know, this happens all the time, are you an alcoholic? So let's say I say yes, okay? So let's say I haven't drank in 9 years. And I say that, I get all the stigma, all their preconceived notions or whatever of being, you know, of being an alcoholic. Even though I haven't drank in 9 years.
Right.
You still... So then I changed the phrasing in my head, and once again, this has worked for me. I can't say it'll work for you. But I just started referring myself as a non-drinker.
Fair enough.
That, I mean, but that there's a different definition there.
For sure. Well, but aren't people more confused by that than they
are? Here's what I usually say. I usually go, I'm not a non-drinker. And then they go, oh, is there a thing? And they go, well, why don't you drink? Because I found this, that if you're in a scenario where everyone's boozing and you're not the guy boozing, a lot of that is thrown on them because they want to continue to drink.
And they think you're judging them.
And yeah, and you, they need you to be going down the rabbit hole with them. And then when you're like, I don't... So I usually go, I don't drink because I'm not afraid of anything. It's usually
that could not go over well.
No, and then that turns into a thing that turns into a conversation that nobody wants to have. And then they just think of a tool and they walk away. But
so wouldn't you rather be judged for being an alcoholic than be considered a tool?
No, not because if I look at, you know, somebody and they go, hey, want a drink? And I go, no, I don't drink. And they go, come on, have another drink. No, dude, I don't drink. Come on, what's what? At that point, I lose my respect for that person. Because if I told you, hey, you know, here... eat the steak, and you were like, I'm a vegetarian, and I go, come on, just put, then I'm kind of a dick.
Well, but that's the thing, is you can definitely silence people with "I'm an alcoholic," because they sort of, they understand that that is not cool to pressure somebody who's a self-declared alcoholic.
Yeah, well, I mean, and this is where my struggle is, and I'm sure a lot of people have this struggle,
yes.
Just that when you say that, like, so some people listening would go, see, typical alcoholic, not admitting he's an alcoholic, right? I mean, that's it.
No.
But look at it this way. Were you in, you were in seventh grade, right?
I was once, yes.
Okay. Do you refer to yourself as a seventh grader?
I don't remember. I doubt it.
Right, but I mean, but there was a time when you acted like a seventh grader.
Right, so then when I was in eighth grade, I didn't do that anymore.
And you were labeled, so you don't refer. So I'm kind of on the thing that you're allowed to be something,
mm-hmm.
in the thing. And then you, like everything in life, is constantly changing.
Mm-hmm.
You shed that skin.
Mm-hmm.
But do you still refer to yourself as that if you're no longer that person? That's, again, that's my internal structure. I don't have an answer for that. I know statistically people who, let's say, used to smoke and then no longer smoke, you know, mm-hmm. let's say they stopped smoking for, you know, years.
They don't say, "I'm a smoker."
They refer to themselves as smoke because they go, "I'm a smoker, but I haven't smoked in..."
I have never heard somebody do that. Ever.
I read it. And if I read it, then I can't tell you where I read it. But why would that stat be in my head if I didn't read it somewhere? I didn't just make it up.
But because you know everything you read online is...
Yeah, I could be...
No, more likely they were.
Or maybe I heard it somewhere.
It couldn't be true. And the only reason that I say it couldn't be true is, well, I smoked for 13 years and I quit. And I even went to a program to quit,
right,
where they say ridiculous things like, "Are you smober?" They say that.
Oh, wow.
As my friend says, "I already know I'm not cool. I don't need to start saying,
right,
I'm smober." But I've never, ever heard someone, I'm around ex-smokers all the time.
All right, I could have. I heard that somewhere.
Oh, so you never smoked?
Oh, no. I think maybe in my life I've smoked less than a pack of cigarettes.
Wow.
Total, I'm 44. So,
yeah.
A decent average.
Yeah.
I think there was a moment or two, probably, you know.
Drunk.
I was 20,
you know.
And the girl I wanted to hook up with smokes, and she went outside, and you're like,
right,
I'll go with you.
Right.
Make sure another guy swoops in.
Must have been a terrible
in.
Smoker.
Yeah, it was bad.
Yeah.
Coughing
and stuff,
yeah,
not inhaling.
I don't even think I inhaled.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I would refer to myself as, you know, a non-drinker. And then, maybe 3 years or... it was sooner than that. My wife got a job working at Diageo. It's the rep, like, tequila.
Mm-hmm.
They're one of the biggest booze companies,
mm-hmm.
in the thing. And so she would run all these events all around Los Angeles where they give out free shots and blah, blah, blah. She was, like, you know, any bar you see girls handing out shots. She was in charge of booking,
mm-hmm.
that, getting the girls. Here's, give out these keychains. So there was a point where we had two Jeeps in our driveway that were completely... black, like, painted with tequila, Jose Cuervo, on the Jeep.
Were they filled with tequila too?
A garage. You pull into the garage, there was nothing but booze and,
mm-hmm.
booze. And it was funny because these Jeeps, one, they were eyesores.
Right.
Right. So I thought my neighbors thought I was broke and needed to, you know,
do an ad
on my
Jeep. By the
Jeep.
Way, you get sort of, somebody put a flyer on my car, which is, okay, you thought my car was cool enough for this. And it was literally, I think, $100 a year. I mean, it's the worst deal ever.
So these Jeeps, and where I live, my driveway, because I live in the hill, there's not even room for a car to park. Like, I live, so it's one of those, so this fucking Jeep would always be in the way. So I also then started conditioning, and I used to love tequila. I used to start conditioning tequila with this pain in the ass, you're in my way, and I have to get out of my car on a busy road, back this into the street, do all this
NLP.
I know. So I literally, I had this crazy association where I didn't, you know, take the feeling of anger and pissed off, and this is an inconvenience to my life, and I would put that literally on the label,
mm-hmm.
that was, like, in the way. So over time, like, even now when I see, like, that brand, I'm like, fuck. You know, just, it made my garage look like a hoarder's garage because we had to have a lot of the swag, you know, all the dumb towels and beach balls and all that stuff was all kind of kept in our garage. So because of that, I've tuned out that like booze and like, even exists. Mm-hmm. Like, it's not even, it's so, like, I hate pickles. I don't think there's anything on earth I hate more than pickles.
Yeah, I don't love them.
If they put them on my plate, I get mad that the pickle juice is soaking into my bread.
Have you ever, this is a dumb question, you never had a fried pickle? I just had one last week, and I liked it.
It's not, okay. I would lose on Fear Factor. If the, on Fear Factor, they just put the pickles that would be on your hamburger down, and said for $50,000, you have to eat one of those.
But yet you would probably would eat something more disgusting.
No, I have food phobias, okay. Like you not believe. I would have a panic attack if you made me eat a pickle. So, with that, when I go into a store, pickles aren't even in my reality. Mm-hmm. I would never even, so they're not there, so it's not like I go to the waiter and go, well, I do actually say I don't want any pickles. Mm-hmm. So I guess I do think about them a lot.
But that's preventative.
This analogy is falling apart. As,
no, it's not.
Same thing with booze. Mm-hmm. It's not an option. Mm-hmm. Eating pickles is never an option for me, so therefore I don't get to, you know.
I mean, I think I'm the same way. I don't see it. I'll accidentally sort of walk down the booze aisle, and I do have an NLP sort of reaction of just like, oof. But I don't, if it's around and I'm around someone drinking it, I don't really have that. But again, it sort of, you know, ceases to be an option.
Yeah, and I, you know, I do a lot of stuff where, you know, you have to, I think people, like, sometimes forget that you're allowed, you kind of bang on yourself and you do crappy things, you kind of get on yourself, but nobody overly rewards themselves for you know, never once do you really go, you know what, that was, I feel really good about saying that. It's always like, oh, I feel shitty for you know, you never do the opposite, you never ride on yourself. So there's a, even now, if we were out and everybody's boozing, and they're like, come on, do you want a glass of wine? And I kind of see everybody with that glossy, you know, eyes that, you know, you go, oh, I kind of missed that feeling. The very next day, when I wake up and I don't feel, I'm not hungover, I don't feel shitty, I don't have to drive back to some bar to find my credit card, you know, and those things, I reward myself and go, I feel really good right now. Why do I feel really good? Because I didn't partake in any of that. And I think if you do that over enough time and you start anchoring that feeling of I feel really good, then, you know, your subconscious starts to go, will help you make those decisions, because it goes, then you're telling your subconscious, hey, this is how I want to feel, so make sure you're helping me make those decisions so I always feel this way. And then your subconscious goes, hey, thanks for the checklist, I appreciate it. Makes our life a little bit easier. So then over time, you know, those pathways in your brain start always pushing you. Like, you know, I go in spurts of creativity and wanting to get things done just as a comic. Like, I gotta do this, and then I should be writing this, and blah, 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 blah. And I always go, boy, I wouldn't have time to, let's say I had a crazy weekend binge partying. I couldn't.
Right.
None of that factors into the goals that I set.
Exactly.
Which I think is another big important thing that probably, you know, helped it along is I've always been really, what do I want to accomplish? And then I backwards engineer it and then go, okay, at any point does, you know, blowing up my liver or sleeping for 3 days factor into getting this? Probably not. So then it's not, again, it's not an option.
Yeah, I get that too, but it's interesting. You know, I was always very ambitious, but and I sort of thought I got stuff done, but I got fired from a lot of jobs, and I, you know, would sort of say, I want to write a book, and you know, but writing a book was something I specifically learned from program, because I would say, oh, I can't write a book, and then I would realize, well, I could write 3 pages a day, and then eventually that would be a book.
Right.
But yes, I mean, I think that realizing that you accomplish a lot more and that you feel a lot better is key. And I agree with you that this, you know, our patting ourselves on the back or whatever, it's the sort of human condition that we don't do that. I mean, I don't think that's limited to people who drank heavily and used drugs.
Yeah, I do a technique that I use on stage, and what I do is I create like a speed button, like on your phone, or it's a form of self-hypnosis. And what I do is I take, if you look at your palm, go the Michigan palm, so go your right side. I take that thumb, I put it underneath you know, I touch my hand with it. How would you describe that? Yeah, you just touch it, right?
Yeah, I don't know.
So take your thumb and just reach over to your
ring finger and put it under.
And then I close my hands, and then I squeeze the thumb. Okay, so that's my trigger. So what happens is, a lot of times when I first started doing this, I would imagine the best case scenario ever. I would imagine, let's say, this was always a performance thing, so on stage I would imagine just the crowd, you know, standing ovation, carrying me over their shoulders, and I think I even, you know, you can go to stuff that actually happened to you. I remember, like, when I won last comic, that feeling in my stomach and balloons dropping. So then, because your brain doesn't know whether something's really happening or it's imaginary. Like, ever have a fake argument with somebody in your car, you'll notice that, you know, by the time you stop at the stoplight, you're physically, your body is physically mad, as if that person is next to you and you're having that conversation.
Right.
Your heart rate's up, you're probably sweating a little, and you're in a pissed off mood, but you completely imagine that entire thing. Or if I ask you, hey, tell me about the lunch you had yesterday, and you told me that story, and then I go, okay, tell me about when the aliens tried to abduct you, and you just made up a story, your brain, except for reality filters, wouldn't know. It's, once something happens, it gets filed into the imagination banks anyway.
Right. I mean, that's sort of like the saying, worrying is praying for things you don't want, because there you are creating a scenario.
Right.
I thought you'd get real excited about that idea, because it's exactly what you're saying.
Yeah, well, so I create that, you know, that happy moment, and then right when I get those feelings, right, like you're on a roller coaster and you're at the top of, like, oh, this is awesome, then I squeeze that thumb. So I'm kind of like putting those feelings into the bank. And like a real bank, you can't withdraw from that until you got to put a lot in. So then what happens is, I use that as a scratch in the record. So if I'm on stage and maybe I'm tired, or I'm, you know, I just flew all day, or I'm pissy, or the show's not going as well as I want, I'll squeeze that thumb, and I put enough positive thoughts into that thumb that even that squeeze, that'll scratch the record, so my brain doesn't play out, this sucks, I'm in a bad mood. It stops me. It's kind of like Cesar Millan with the dog. It's the human version of that thing you do with the dog.
Right, I haven't seen it, but I get it.
Yeah, he just puts his hand in, and when your dog's looking at a squirrel and growling, you do this little to the neck, and then it snaps your dog. It takes the focus off the squirrel, then you can talk to the dog. So I do that when I come home and my dogs are excited to see me. I'll squeeze the thumb. You know, so I have all these, like, positive moments that I have, and then I use that thumb squeeze.
That's amazing.
All the time. So, like, and I also do that if I'm out, and then I, like I said, boredom will be the thing that puts me under. Like, it's usually, it's, if I'm bored and I'm like, oh, you know what, I should just, what's, I'm not an alcoholic, I should have a drink. Like, that's when I'll squeeze my thumb, and then that'll.
Does it make you unbored?
No, then I'll leave. But at least I didn't play out the, I'm bored, but let me just have a drink. Then I just have a drink. At least I never let the movie run all the way to the end like that.
Yeah.
That's my hitting stop, on that movie.
Well, and you literally can change the neural pathways, which is what you're saying.
Yeah.
So that it rewrites and rewires the way your brain actually works, which I do think is a huge part of program that they don't actually get into, because they don't get into the whys. Why does this work?
Yeah.
I think.
Yeah. Yeah, because, well, an NLP approach to that was not like, why do you drink? You know? Like, you know, it's when, like, when do you want to? It's not like, so it's really not about the past, like, oh, my dad wasn't around, and then he was abusive, and then blah blah blah. That's like, that's your past story. But now it's about today. What was the stimulus that made you want that drink today, you know?
Well, and I wouldn't say that the program does that either.
No, but then how do you then stop? Then you figure out that stimulus, and then you find a way to rewire it so it doesn't play out. Yeah.
I mean, I think a misconception about program is that people think everybody comes in and talks about how they want to drink, which I, you know, I've been around for 13 and a half years. I've heard that you know, a handful of times.
Yeah.
But we're talking about getting, you know, sort of getting to a place where you just don't even want to.
Yeah. It, you know, I think, and then with that, though, the one thing that I think the program was really good for was just that camaraderie, mm-hmm. just that thing. Mm-hmm. Like, I enjoyed, like, after the meeting,
mm-hmm.
you know, just, you know, the hugs and the thing. And mm-hmm. you'd see somebody that you knew was struggling last week,
mm-hmm.
and you had a sense of purpose, especially when you saw somebody new,
mm-hmm.
you know, so you kind of got, you know, gratification from helping somebody, mm-hmm. you know, get through that. I performed at the NA meeting in California.
Oh, the convention.
The convention. There's probably, you know, thousands of people there. And I'm walking around the convention. And if those of you who don't know what I look like, I'm pretty clean cut.
For sure.
You know, very just, I'm from Michigan.
But N.A., but you didn't do drugs, or did you?
No.
Okay.
But I performed. Like, I knew somebody who was in the thing. Yeah. You should have this guy. He was...
Is it that recovery comedy little group?
Yeah. So they go, you should perform at this mm-hmm. thing. So I'm walking around this hotel.
Can I ask a terrible question? Yeah. Do they pay you for those conventions?
Yes. Not...
Not great.
Not a lot.
Right.
It's kind of gas and getting up there, right. and here's a hotel for you. It's kind of volunteer. But I did it. I just mm-hmm. wanted to... But after, you know, I've been in every scenario ever as a stand-up, you know, on TV, doing Last Comic or Tonight Shows or whatever, in front of millions. I've never been more afraid to walk on stage than when I was at this thing. Because if you see me and then you see everybody who was there, you would go, who would be the polar opposite of, you know, but here's the thing. We're all the same people.
Right.
Like, it's all, like, so that's just me in my head going, these guys have tattoos all over their face. You know? I mean, like, a lot of the guys there are, like, third striker guys where if they don't show that they're doing this type of stuff, they're going to jail forever. And then there's guys with leather motorcycle gangs saying sober for God. But, you know, but they were all really, really, like, I was intimidated. There were women with, like, names in cursive under their eyes. You know,
Okay, maybe that's, yeah, an
NA thing. Yeah, so it was, and then I get backstage, and the sound guy goes, hey, we've had this guy here, they like it if you're really dirty, really go after them. And my act is so far from going after people and being really dirty.
Mm-hmm.
So now it was literally, I text another comic who's in the program, I go, dude, I'm like, he's like, they look intimidating, but they're going to be awesome.
Mm-hmm.
Chill out. Mm-hmm. So then I got on stage, and I even forgot what I said. I go, you know what, don't judge me, even though I look like the guy who put most of you in jail, in the place, whatever. And then I had one of the greatest shows. Like, it was 1,000 people that, like, if you were to go, if you know, draw a picture of somebody who would hate John the most, mm-hmm. you would draw a picture of 98% of everybody.
Mm-hmm.
Had a just unbelievable show, got off the stage, to, you know, I was going to run back to my room and then
drive back. 1,000 people wanted to shake your hand.
I hugged easily 300 of, like, you know, opposite of
gang bangers.
Yeah, just like, and it had some, like, great conversations and da 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 da. And, you know, it was a pretty cool, you know, empowering, you know, thing for me to show that, like, that's what all, like, you know, going to meetings and stuff like that actually does, because it shows you that you don't have to be hung out to dry by yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's mm-hmm. the thing. Like, no matter, and I even say this on stage, no matter what scenario is going on in your life, like, people tend to think that you know, maybe because their parents said, you're unique, you're a special butterfly, nobody's like you. You tend to think your scenario is so, like, well, no one's ever gone through what I'm going through.
Absolutely.
And you go, really, dumbass? There's a billion people that have gone through the same exact thing you did, and there's a billion people that have ways for you to get out of mm-hmm. that scenario. Quit thinking that you're unique. It's mm-hmm. not. Well, my dad, and da-da-da, and then I lost. Okay, here's 8,000 guys that have, and yes. here's how they did it. So that's what is cool about going to meetings, is you go, oh, really, I'm not that special? Everybody does this? Then maybe I should get over myself,
yes.
get over my ego, and, you know, stop doing it. Because that's the thing, another big thing that really helped me is, I forgot where it was, but this guy was telling this story just about, it's called timeline therapy, where you go through life, he walks you through this thing that you're like, you're going down a dirt road, and there's a bunch of houses with mailboxes, and as you're walking, you see your 18-year-old self come to the end of the driveway, and your 18-year-old self looks at you and says, "Hey, man, you know, keep going that way. That's where everything you want is, but don't take shit from everybody." Mm-hmm. And then you walk a little bit further, then your 20-year-old self comes up and goes, "Hey, you're doing a great job, da-da-da." And you eventually get to this big field, and the guy's doing a better job than I am, but you get to this big field where you see the oldest you, and you're surrounded by people who love you, and you see, you know, grass is full of, like, kids and family and friends, and you have a beautiful house.
And so the you that's older than you are right now.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. The, you know, your future you. Mm-hmm. And then he meets you at the end of this thing and goes, "Listen, you have everything you want. This is your house. This is your beautiful family. This is your dogs. This is your car. There's everything. But to get here, to get back here, there's some things you need to start doing back there, mm-hmm. and some things you need to stop doing. And you know exactly what they are." And then you turn around and go. But I thought, even to this day, that, you know, that phrase is so powerful, because it's not, you don't have to go on a huge journey. Mm-hmm. Like, you don't have to read 8,000 books. Like, mm-hmm. that simple thing, what do you need to start doing now, mm-hmm. and what do you need to stop? It's, those answers will come to you like that, mm-hmm. until your second voice starts, you know, shitting on your, but your initial answer. So if it's, "I should probably stop drinking or doing drugs." Mm-hmm. Okay. Mm-hmm. So let's check that off. Mm-hmm. That's one step closer to having this also. What else do you know? Mm-hmm. So that really was, you know, pretty powerful.
I don't mean to keep bringing it back to how amazing the program is, but I would say that's also the purpose of the steps in finding your defects and apologizing for things that you're very resentful about or whatever it is.
Yeah, and in letting it go, mm-hmm. and all that stuff, and having to go back to you know, those people, you know, that maybe shit on a little, mm-hmm. and kind of just square that away. Mm-hmm. At least it's closure. Mm-hmm. There's no. They could still hate you. Mm-hmm. You could still have done some heinous thing, but you
that's
know.
That's on them.
But you already did it. So it's already done. Mm-hmm. So now it's kind of about, like, putting you back together. And like I said, like, yeah, that's how I was in seventh grade. Mm-hmm. I was really shitty in seventh grade, but I'm not a seventh grader anymore. Mm-hmm. Like, so who is the new person, and how do I move forward? What do I need to start doing? What do I need to stop? I think. And it's work, though. I mean, I think about all that stuff when I say I don't think about booze, but I still, every day I'm thinking about how can I, you know, what do I need to do to make sure that when I'm on the hill meeting the old John Heffron, mm-hmm. that, you know, he's not pissed at me.
So it's sort of a version of Matthew McConaughey's Oscar speech that actually makes sense. Do you remember that? My hero is my future me.
Yeah. Speech. Yeah, yeah.
So how often do you have to do that imagining? You know, does a guide take you through that, or do you do it to yourself?
No, I ask myself those questions a lot. Like, I literally...
Do you do it as a visualization? You sort of sit down?
I do, because I'm really... Like, I've even... That particular story, it just moves me so much, because I'm... Obviously, I wrote a book called I Come to You from the Future, mm-hmm. and I think there's something very powerful in... What would happen if you met your 18-year-old self? Mm-hmm. How pissed off would that person be, mm-hmm. at what you've become? Mm-hmm. You know, because you make decisions. Everything in your life is decisions that you've made to get there. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's probably certain phases of you that would question why the you now, mm-hmm. made those decisions.
But that part, to me, sounds less than healthy. Because it's sort of, you know, trying, you know, not to regret the past and not to beat yourself up, you know, wouldn't that sort of perpetuate doing those things?
Well, I think for me, just, you know, and a lot of it's kind of for fun, because I love doing that scenario, like that little story I told, Ron. I've recorded myself doing it and just getting really deeper, and you know what I mean?
Cool.
Deeper. So I'm constantly asking, you know, that question, like, okay, even, you know, this week, what do I need to start? What do I need to stop? What do, mm-hmm. you know, how did last week go for me? And what didn't I like about last week? And then da 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 da.
Do you write it down so that you can remember?
No, I have a lot of talks to myself.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Like, yeah, because I, like, on booze or related, I had a thing where I wanted, like, going through a phase where I need something to happen.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't even necessarily have an answer to what that is. But I remember, like, last week, I was just like, man, I'm on the road 46 weeks a year, da-da-da-da, but it's a means to an end, because when you travel like that, your years go by just, like,
mm-hmm.
go like that. So I'm like, I need something to happen, da-da-da. And then for, like, a couple days, I was bummed that, you know, nothing was happening and stuff. And then I go, okay, well, what do I need to start doing? Okay, to make stuff. And then, you know, I start going, okay, I should probably do this. I should probably boost up my podcast again. I should do this and try to, you know, stuff like that. So what do I need to start doing is actually work. What do I need to stop doing? Bitching about not having the thing. Because it's all,
yes.
you know, it's all in your control. But not like the secret stuff. Not just, I'm going to sit here and wish for something to happen. There's actual work involved, and you have to go, what are my steps? And and even if you start doing something wrong, that's still better than not doing anything at all.
So
like, right when I wrote my book, I was like, I didn't know how to write a book and stuff, and I'm the worst speller, and I'm the worst, you know, in the history of the world. But I was like, I'm going to start either way. I'm going to do it wrong.
Mm-hmm.
At least that'll get in. Then, you know, then I eventually found out, oh, I can hire an editor. Oh, I can just talk into this thing and have it transcribed.
Oh, is that how you did it?
Yeah, and then have an editor kind of make, you know, get rid of all my ums and ahs, and you know, I figured it out. Yeah.
That's, I mean, and I do think that's the thing about,
I'm not a writer. I'm not, like, you know.
Yeah, but look, I will say that people who are really, I guess, quote, are writers, the thing, you know, because I don't believe in writer's block, and you'll hear writers complain about it, and the way that I don't believe in it is, I'm going to throw it out anyway. So writing is rewriting. So I think it's perfectionism that causes people to think that they have writer's block. If you know it's going to sort of suck because first drafts kind of do,
right.
then you don't get stymied by that.
Yeah, I've always gone, like, anything I've created, I've just done it. And I go in phases if I cared about what people thought about. You know, I just wanted to do it, but then, you know, my brain goes, like, if I start working on one project, then my brain will start thinking about another project. And then sometimes that second project wouldn't have came about unless I started, you know, project one.
Mm-hmm.
So then I'll bail on project one. So my biggest problem is, like, follow through.
Yes.
But I've also had success being kind of scatterbrained, just having, you know, like in the early 90s-ish. Me and a buddy created this card game called the That Guy Game. It was for bachelorettes. It was a game where on these cards was a different type of guy you would see out at the bar.
Mm-hmm.
And then you pass out the cards to everybody, you know, in your party. And then you go out and then you try to find the real life version of the cartoon guy. So
it's like a scavenger hunt.
It was a scavenger hunt for guys. So it was like, you know, sweaty dancer guy, use fake ID to get in guy, big gut, skinny legs guy. It was just all these, you know, caddy cards with women, just puked in the bathroom chick, and stuff like that. So we started to create this, and we had zero idea on how to do a card game, you know, because it wasn't our thing. So we kind of piecemealed it together, and then we were in Larchmont Village, which is a little trendy area in here in Los Angeles, and we went into, like, a boutique store, and we said, hey, can you sell these cards? Can you just put them on?
Well, so you made them.
We made them.
Mm-hmm.
We made, like, 1,000, you know, things. I think that was the run. Like, this company made you buy print 1,000. So they're like, sure. And then we came back to go, did you sell any? She goes, yeah, we sold, like, 3 of them. You know, not our profit was we made $6. And they go, we sold one to Drew Barrymore, bought one yesterday. And then, for some reason, she ended up back in whatever magazine it was playing the game.
Amazing.
Then Julia Roberts bought the game. Then Glamour Magazine did a full page spread where they had a picture of our card and then the celebrity that matched the card. Full page in Glamour. Then we were in, from there, we were in InStyle, InTouch, and stuff like that. And suddenly now, we were, like, selling crazy amount of games. But this was back in the 90s where there wasn't, like online
Twitter and all of that stuff.
And there wasn't a lot of online fulfillment companies. Mm-hmm. So we were literally, we'd wake up at like 5 o'clock in the morning, get our orders because you could only buy them online. Mm-hmm. And we would sit there and we'd go to the post office with, you know, hundreds of these games. And then we ended up just letting that kind of peter out because we didn't know how to do the business. We got a patent on the scavenger hunt game, like the way to do it.
Revive it now, it would be crazy.
I know, right? Like now we have, one, the money to get it done right, and two, we would never have to touch a game because there's 8 billion companies just even on Amazon alone.
Yes.
We do it. But that was one of those follow-throughs where we just came up with an idea and we just, you know, started doing it even if we were doing it wrong.
How much did you make in the end?
Well, we sold it as a TV show also. This was all, you know, and then it disappeared as fast just because we were 20. We were like our mid-20s. Mm-hmm. And I was like, I'm going to be a comic. I'm not a card, you know. Mm-hmm. So we had all these, we were going to do a gay version. We were going to do this and that. And just recently, my buddy I did it with, he's a huge TV producer. He's got like, you know, 6 or 7 shows on air right now. And I keep telling him, I go, dude, we just need to bring that back. We can just hire somebody to do it for us. And then we just now...
Or just make it a TV show now that he's the big producer.
Yeah. So, but that was, I don't know how we got off.
But that's fascinating. I had an idea for a card game in the 90s.
Oh, that's funny.
And mine was Match the Celebrity with the Scandal because I was working at People Magazine.
Right.
And I got the guy who's, one of the guys who started Wire Image was giving me the rights to all these photos. And then I just didn't know anything and I just let it peter out. But you're giving me a good idea. The sober version.
Yeah.
But I can't, I could steal it. We've got witness that I'm stealing it.
Let's co-create.
Because what I was going to say about follow through and what was interesting about that was, I think, a motivated partner. Because partnerships are complicated because oftentimes I found I'm the one who does all the work and then I'm the one that gets resentful. Like starting After Party, I had 3 people that I wanted to partner with and they were fully into it and then didn't do anything.
Yeah. That's I always wish that I just have a little stenographer or a little, you know. I always thought that would be a great business and I'm sure it exists now.
Wait, what do you mean?
Like where you share an assistant? Share, like, you know what I mean? Because assistants are expensive. Like, you know, somebody who, because, you know, but let's say you had somebody that would go, listen, we'll give you 40 hours a week of work. But you split it.
It's like the office sharing we were talking about before, but so much better.
Now you have this one assistant that is works with 3, but you're all a collective. So everybody ponies up.
You divide the time.
Yeah, you probably, because let's say all the ideas that I have and stuff, I don't even know how to time management. So, mm-hmm. If somebody was my assistant, they'd be getting emails at 3 o'clock in the morning going, mm-hmm. I need a banner for this. Hey, can we do this?
So you'd be the nightmare in the triumvirate, basically.
Yeah, because I'd be very bad at, from Wednesday to... Yes. My stuff just kind of pops in randomly. That's the thing. I'm not very good at...
You do need an assistant.
I'm not very good yet. That's another thing.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That's a great idea. There's stuff that I do that I just don't do as well. I sort of screw it up because I just don't have the time.
Yeah.
To, you know, good thing too is I have 2 amazing interns, but they also write for the site, so they get paid.
Right.
They got a good deal. But it was crazy when I put the ad out for interns. I got 200 applicants on Craigslist.
Wow.
And it's just a sad statement about, you know, the economy and what college graduates have to deal with.
Right.
You know, I thought it was bad when I graduated.
I didn't think about that.
Yeah. But you also get what you pay for. The fact that I am paying my interns means I got the best. My intern went to Harvard and Yale.
Right.
Grad school. Wow. Yeah. Yeah, I know. She's a billion times smarter than I am.
Right.
But yeah, that's a good thing to do. And it's true. I mean, like in sobriety or whatever, you can do anything. You really can do these things. I mean, not to say you need to be sober to do anything.
Right, but it's amazing. I realized the biggest thing was after I stopped drinking, how much I didn't have to tip out the bartenders at the end of the week. Because I'm at a comedy club Wednesday through Sunday. You know, and if you're going up to the bar after every show and then, hey, I'll buy drinks for the opening act because he's broke. Mm-hmm. And then the thing, before you know it, like even that alone, I was like, dang, look at all the money. And just being able to wake up in the morning and not hungover, like just the cost, it's the, you know, the cost versus rewards thing. And now I've just got it that
well,
I had a moment like where here's another thing where once I sealed up the seal that I kind of really closed a lot of the doors on a decision where there used to be a bar where I would go. Well, it's a bar restaurant in Michigan called Giannopoulos's. It was a really, it's where all the Pistons hung out. A lot of mafia guys hung out there. It was like, and so I was like 10, 11, 12. We'd go eat there, and my mom hung out there. There was a booze that was up in this glass case. You needed a key to get into it. I think it was like Glenfiddich or something. One of those like $150, $200 shot boozes. And I'd always sit there with my mom, and I would stare up at that thing because it was in this awesome case, and it was the glass that just looked. And I'd see these like mafia guys like order it, and these guys had huge watches and ring. Like, you know, you're 12, going, oh man, when I'm their age, this is totally how I'm.
You were in this bar at 12. Oh, it was a restaurant too.
It was like a restaurant. Mm-hmm. It was like a high end, you know, like Ruth Chris, let's say.
Right.
You know, one of those type places where everybody was in suits.
Ruth's Chris.
Yeah, right? Yeah. So I would look at that, and I remember asking my mom, what is that up there? And she goes, oh, that's for really special occasions. Like, usually if somebody's birthday or if somebody dies, everybody comes in and they have a thing, but it's, you know, that's for big things. So I go, and every time, you know, over the years, you know, I would eat at this restaurant. I think we even had, like, a homecoming dance dinner there where we took the dates out, and I would see the thing. So then, before my mom passed away, I stopped drinking. I don't know the math on it. Let's say 8 months in or so. It doesn't matter. So I go to this restaurant. Now, I think 2 days after we buried my mom or something like that. And I'm sitting there because I just wanted to sit in the same booth that we always ate at. Because this restaurant, you know, meant a lot to me. And I was staring up at that thing. And I go, fuck, you know what? Who gives a shit? This is a special occasion. Da 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 da. And then I go, I'll take a shot of that. Now keep in mind, I've been staring at this thing since I was 12. And this is the thing. So the bartender puts the thing, and I stared at that shot easily an hour. Easily. I sat there, and I would hold it, and then I would set it down. And then I'd back away. And then my stomach would get knots, and then I'd grab it. You know, it's almost like you're trying to, like, bungee jump or something. You're like, and then I had every conversation in my head was, okay, just have the do the shot, and then go back to a meeting tomorrow and start over.
Right.
So who cares? I see that happen a trillion times.
Right.
Right. Then the guy came, sat next to me, older dude, knew my mom. We started having that conversation. He was telling some funny stories about my mom at the bar, blah, 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 blah. And I took that and I slid it over to him. And I go, that's on me and stuff. He was like, oh, what is this? I go, so there, I kind of told him the story. I told him why I wasn't. And then he slammed it. And he goes, yeah, I don't know if it's worth 200. Like, he said something kind of funny. But after that moment, I kind of challenged myself going, okay, if I said no to it under a scenario that anybody would have probably maybe given me a free pass. Going, yes. You would have, I mean, free pack, but
I mean, justified. You still would have had to start over, but justified.
But justified. And yes. That was the one that then, now any other scenario.
Yes.
Given that to me, it so can't come close to the weight of that, that's why that even makes me go, no.
More.
A billion times.
More easier. NLP.
Yeah, a billion times. Like, if I wasn't going to do it then, why would I do it just because I'm in Toledo, Ohio.
And bored. Right.
Yeah. So.
That's amazing.
So I don't know if that ended up helping. I don't know if that thing, you know, like you'd like to put, like, make it romantic and go, well, that was the thing. And, you know,
if your life was a movie, which it still could be, because with all this, what's going to happen in the future.
Right.
That would be a big.
That was maybe my mom going, nah, let me do this. Wow. And now it's a thing. And, you know.
That's
really the story was the whole time, saying that this is a thing to celebrate, blah, blah, blah. Maybe that was all pushed in the direction to stop something. Mm-hmm. Who knows? I mean, mm-hmm. Now I'm reaching for a plot point.
No, but I think you're right. I think that that's true. So we didn't even get into Last Comic Standing. Should we get into that?
Sure.
So you were in it twice, and you won the second time?
I won Last Comic, yeah, season two. And then they made us do a season three because the show was pretty popular at the time.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't want to do season three, but they kind of made me. So, you know.
And the money was probably decent.
No, it wasn't. At the time, it was... at scale, you know, it was all because it fell into that reality world. So it was all, you know, scaled.
And your career radically changed as a result
of
that?
Yeah, our last comic, I believe, our season won an Emmy, and I think we had like 12, 13 million viewers
mm-hmm.
during that time, like the current last comic. Funny people on there, but I think that's at a million.
It's on right now?
Yeah.
Okay, well.
Yeah, it's like a million, mm-hmm. you know, so it was like, so when we were on, I was on... Just during that sweet spot when, like,
yes.
everybody watched it. And, you know, that was the thing. I think I did, like, a Tonight Show or, you know, I had a half-hour special prior to Last mm-hmm. Comic. But Last Comic was definitely the thing.
Mm-hmm.
And now you just need a new thing. Like, that's the thing.
That's the problem with, I'll be happy when I make $100,000. Because as soon as, you know, I used to lament that my books weren't bestsellers. And then I met a lot of writers who had best-selling books, and all the world wanted them to do was do it again, and they had to live in the shadow of their biggest success being behind them.
Yeah. Like, I refer to it as, you know, Last Comic was the biggest TV I've done. I've had a bunch of deals where, like, we've had, you know, we've worked on pilots and stuff.
Yes.
But so you, I mean, even getting that is a huge accomplishment, but then there's so many different... levels, but then they get that pilot then picked up is a whole nother. So I've come close a couple times, but you know, I sometimes battle with that, going, what if that was it? What if back then was the only time I was able to dunk the ball once, and then
but that
now my
doesn't
vertical
work
sucks?
With the way you live your life.
Yeah.
I mean, the 37 or however old you were version of yourself would not be down with that.
Right.
I would think.
Right.
And I think that also getting that it doesn't matter, I mean, it matters, but that, you know, it took me a long time to realize that career was never going to be the thing. You know, that no external thing was going to be the thing that was going to bring me everything.
Yeah, it's funny, you know, the house I have here and stuff is all great, but, like, lately I've had fantasies of ditching it, buying a farm in the Midwest on, like, 30 acres and... being outside with my German Shepherds and just kind of scaling it down, like,
mm-hmm.
would you be, or is it just you searching for that thing? I think you're always searching.
And always sort of wanting something that you don't have.
For a thing, or thinking, you know, like, oh, if I get this, this will replace this. Like, all I need is a new shirt, probably.
Right.
Once I get a new outfit, that's going to really change my life. And it does for that second you have it on.
Yes.
And then that shirt that you really needed to buy, you probably shouldn't have charged, is now in the bottom of your closet, and you're taking it to Goodwill a year later.
Still, if it served that purpose at that time.
At that time.
I think of that whenever I clean out my closet.
Yeah.
You know, it got me through.
Yeah, and I'm going through that phase. It's very. I think that's one of the toughest things. I've signed up for some program where every day... they send you an email of something you need to get rid of in your house. It's like 30 days
mm-hmm.
to minimal or something. So it'll be like your task, you know, today would be one junk drawer in your kitchen. And you just break it down, because cleaning out your house, it's too overwhelming. It's
yes.
too much. You're going to go, F it, I'm going to sit on the couch and watch TV.
Mm-hmm.
But when you go, all I want you to do today is go to that one drawer, dump it.
Mm-hmm.
Keep a couple
mm-hmm.
batteries, but everything else, you don't need.
Those cords for those things that you
throw
away.
Yeah, because eventually you realize life isn't about a drawer full of old cell phone chargers
yes.
that no longer work.
Yes.
So, yeah, so you go through step by step, and, you know, it's hard, though.
Yes, it is, but that's so metaphoric, too, for cleaning out these things, that the things you're going to stop doing. And the things you're going to start doing.
Yeah, and also, program-wise, you know, staying sober for life, it's too overwhelming.
Yes.
It's too much.
Yes.
It's too much. One drawer.
Absolutely.
One drawer. That's all you gotta worry about.
I need to. You need to forward me that. I want to get on that email.
The junk drawer today. That's it. That's all you need to clean
up. Did you do it before you came over here, or was that not the one today?
No, that wasn't the one. Like, one is like I think today's was like a sock thing or something. You know, but all little tedious things, but the whole goal is over 30 days. Like, and he has pictures of, you know, people like take pictures of the junk drawer being thrown away.
Mm-hmm.
So they just, I think there's even a Facebook page where people do it. And you see, oh, look at all that trash that person, and you start to visualize it, and then you do it. And then over the course of 30 days, you know.
Well, and then it's the camaraderie that program gives, because going through it with other people.
Yeah, and then you see examples. And you see examples, and you see people that have done it successfully.
Right.
Because I remember when I would go to the program, somebody would tell me, you'll see, like, after a week or so, you'll look at yourself in the mirror, and you'll see how your eyes are clearer.
Did you
just
do that?
And they're just, like, white. You know, like, you have...
I never noticed that.
Oh, right. Yeah, because you see people, like, first dayers, or people get... And you just, you know, they have that look on their face, and then over time, you see it. Or you see somebody who's done it for, you know, I'm so-and-so, I've been sober for 35 years, and you go, wow, 35 years, that guy? When you're trying to make it through the day.
Yes.
So it's good to see examples.
Yes.
But that's going back to, I guess... the end of this, the beginning, is that's where I get conflicted, where you know, there's good parts about it, but then there's other parts where you go, I don't want to say, you know, booze all day. That's my, like I said, that's my internal.
And you are certainly not the only one.
Yeah.
Like,
I wish there was an updated version. You couldn't really do that, but I wish there's some committee that goes, here's a little bit, you know, we're going to tweak the approach.
Yeah, I mean, there are committees. Hey, with your convention popularity, you could head it. But those committees are not interested in change, and I get that in a way, because it's working for a lot of people.
Yeah.
So... you know,
it's so individual. I think everybody has a different experience. You know?
Absolutely,
other people.
But what's interesting is that I think a lot of people go, they get angry about that. I'm not going to be an alcoholic my whole life, and they start to, you know, rail against the program and start websites about how evil the program is and all of that stuff. Whereas, you know, you can just do what you do, which is go, I don't believe that.
Yeah,
but
there are some good points. And through this process that I will take up. And I, you know, most of that, except for this show, I keep all of that to myself.
Yes.
Like, so like if I'm in a meeting, I play by those rules.
Yes.
I'm not the douche that looks at somebody after day one and goes, you know what? Were you in seventh grade once? Like, I would never do that. I would never, you know what I mean?
Right.
Right.
That's good. Yeah, I bet at the convention you kind of chilled out on those opinions.
I didn't say anything. I just did my stuff.
Well, this has been awesome.
I really appreciate you having me.
I really appreciate your doing it. It's great, and I'm looking forward to our card game success.
Yes, I know. Yeah.
Aren't you? Okay, we're all good. What a nice, smart, interesting guy he was. Yeah, right? Did you learn some things? I did. I hope and imagine you really liked that. That was John Heffron. If you've got something to say about me, say it on iTunes. Make it nice. See you next time.